Good morning. This is going to be a different sort of Sunday here at Nexus. Today, we'll showcase members of our Preaching Guild, a ragtag group of folks here at Nexus interested in and committed to both speaking and storytelling. Back in season 5, Brad proposed the cultivation of a group like this for the express purpose of adding more voices, creating meaningful talks, and making special things happen on Sunday mornings. The voices have changed over the seasons, but the process has not. Each guild member has braved the rather rigorous step of presentation preparation before they get up here and speak. Today's Guild Sunday will feature most of the members of Season 9's Guild and is just a preview of what is yet to come. Each guild member will pop up again in some capacity once more within season 9 to explore the archaeology of the ordinary. The ordinary is something I have become acutely familiar with. Nearly 2 years ago now, I became a mother. I love my son more than I ever thought possible. But once the novelty of having a baby wore off, I began to realize that my life had drastically changed. It was boring. Having a baby that only napped well in his crib meant that I was home most of the time. It meant that I was no longer spending my days caught up in social justice-y type causes or taking off on road trips to exotic places on weekends or hiking and rock climbing with friends. I was home, surrounded by nagging internal reminders to mop the floor, do the laundry, and wash the dishes amidst the relentless feeding of mouths, wiping of bums, and protecting of sleep. Kathleen Norris, in her essay, The Quotidian Mysteries, Laundry, Liturgy, and Women's Work, states, "The fact that none of us can rise so far in status as to remove ourselves from the daily bodily nature of life on this earth is not usually considered a cause for celebration, but rather the opposite. The daily routines that provide a modicum of discipline in our lives are perceived as a drag, a monotony that can occasion listlessness, apathy, and despair. For years, much of my 20s and 30s, I had quietly been yearning to be a mom. And now that it was staring me in the face, I was wishing to chop it up and toss out all the dull bits. The thing is, in my day-to-day life, there are so many dull bits, it's troubling. Let's take a closer look. There is something sobering about this video. It presses upon us the urgency of time. How many days or jelly beans do we have left? How do we want to spend it? It visually highlights how little time we have to actually do the things we love or are passionate about. But if we spend 20,620 days doing the most ordinary of things, why would we simply swipe them away as if they are worthless? That is 88% of our time. 88% of our lives will be spent living in the ordinary. What if all these boring, ordinary pieces I'm wishing to chop up and toss out matter in the grand scheme of things? What if days that pass in ways that feel both small and insignificant to us are actually weighty with meaning and part of the full, abundant life that God has for us? The video misses the mark in my mind. Instead of asking what we are going to do with the little time we have outside of the ordinary, the better question to me would be this: given how much time we will spend doing ordinary things, how do I perform those ordinary things well? How do we pirate the ordinary to take back all that time? This is what the archaeology of the ordinary is all about. Digging in to examine our own cultural artifacts and helping us never look at what is ordinary the same way again. In the words of Harriet Chessman, helping us to see the exquisite worlds within ordinary things. Helping us open our eyes to the shimmering spirituality of the ordinary and what it can teach us about faith. Once again, let's set sail.
Bones. I am fascinated by them. They're surprisingly revealing. I spent some time as an archaeologist digging for pre-European contact artifacts in Ontario. Before that, I studied the human skeletal system. Something I discovered is that there are three ways to find out information about a person. You can learn from what they tell you, what they show you, and what they leave behind. Most archaeologists focus on what's been left behind, but a bioarchaeologist looks specifically at what is left behind on a person's bones. You would be surprised at how much information about yourself can fit into a small box when its only contents are your bones. These professionals translate scientific traits and can interpret them into what you may have looked like or acted like while you were still alive. Without any background information, a stranger could identify your age, gender, or ethnicity. They could see how strong you were. Someone with this training can look at your bones and see how much pain your arthritis caused you. They can see how many times you broke your leg as a kid or how long it took for them to heal. How long a fracture took to heal. They could see which muscles were strengthened and infer that a certain sport or activity was common practice or even your favorite. They could understand the process of any physical trauma sustained on your bones. And while they can't know for sure what emotional trauma followed, they can imagine your pain as their own. I have visited one of these labs in Guatemala, and I studied in one here at home. When you first walk into one of these laboratories, you see boxes or bins, and each one of these holds a person and their story. My first time there, each set of bones looked exactly the same. They were like cookie cutters or one of those replicas you see at the doctor's office or something that your neighbor might put on their lawn at Halloween. But these real bones are heavier and delicate. The more time you spend with them, the more time you can spell them up, you can tell them apart. They become individuals. When I narrowed my focus to one set of remains, I realized that each set is as unique as the snowflakes that we compare ourselves to. When you're coming into a lab day after day, working on a report of the same person, you start to see them. I saw that I was spending 8 hours a week with a white man between the ages of 30 and 35. I was writing a report detailing every piece of information that I could read from his bones. He had bad knees and a shoulder injury. He was 5'10". He didn't have any cavities. He had a remodeled fracture on his jaw that I was convinced was evidence that he was punched in the face at one point. These are very personal, rather intimate interactions that are completely one-sided. You see someone in a way that no one else has before. Bones and story exposed. It's a beautiful picture of vulnerability. I knew so much information about this man. I gave him a nickname. I would include him in my conversations as if he was alive and present and I was looking at his x-rays. I had to remind myself that even though I knew so much information about this man, I had no idea who he was. There are some things that don't show up in the bones. I had done a facial reconstruction, but I didn't know what color his eyes were. I didn't know what his hair looked like or what his personality was like. Did he squint when he was thinking about something? Did he wear glasses? Was he an introvert or an extrovert? Did his smile change when he was looking at someone he cared for? Was he sarcastic or was he rude? Was he the type of person I would have gotten along with, or would I also have wanted to punch him in the face? It's an interesting phenomenon to know so much information about a person whom you've never seen. It's kind of like having a pen pal, except they're dead and they don't read your letters. It's vulnerable for both of us, but again, it's completely one-sided. My hope is that this man, whose bones I read, had someone in his life who knew him better than I did. Someone who had all the information that I had and also the information that I lacked. The intimacy and intrigue I found in studying the remains of another person, someone I had never met, this one-sided exploration of what made him unique, it made me want to push towards being more vulnerable myself. It made me want to know others and be known this clearly, and it made me wonder, do we ever see ourselves with this much clarity? Do we let the people we love see us like this? The people who raised us, the people we marry, all the people that we spend our lives with every day. with no masks to hide our fears, no clothes to hide our scars, and no skin to hide our bones. It takes courage to let yourself be really seen and really known. Eventually, our bones will tell people our story. But when I think about it, I would rather be the one telling my own story. I would rather people know me the most while I am alive. This is archaeology of the ordinary. The archaeology of bones, unearthing vulnerability.
So this here is my sister. A few years ago, she was living in Guelph and wanted to attend a protest going on in Toronto. And while I've always admired her steadfast dedication to a variety of worthwhile causes, I have not always admired her decision-making. You see, at the time, she did not own a car. And she also happens to believe that fossil fuels are destroying this beautiful human-forsaken sphere we call home. So instead of buying a Greyhound ticket like a normal person in her situation might, she decides she is going to bike from Guelph to Toronto. So she sets out with a few friends who also see the folly in fossil fuels. If my memory serves me right, the protest was going on in Nathan Phillips Square. Don't get me started about how that is right by the Greyhound station. At some point on her journey, my sister begins to feel a little bit faint. Perhaps it was a hot day, perhaps it was from the distance, or perhaps it was from all of the emissions. She's going down a hill, and she finds herself losing control of her bike. Next thing she knows, she's on the ground with her helmet beside her. The thing is in two pieces. That's right, her helmet cracks straight in half, right down the middle. Her, she's in one piece, aside from a bit of a headache. So, what's the moral of the story? Well, you're probably thinking that's obvious. Don't bike from Guelph to Toronto on a hot day when you're feeling faint, no matter how important the cause. But you're wrong. The true moral to the story is your head is like a watermelon. Always wear your helmet. So thank God for this simple piece of styrofoam technology, and maybe consider wearing it more often. Because let's face it, riding a bike can be perilous. Cars are unpredictable, pavement is hard, and skulls, even mine, are only so thick. Personally, I think it's crazy that no contact sport introduced a helmet at the same time that the sport itself was invented. I can't imagine, for example, being a football linebacker without at least some protective barrier between my head and the players who will inevitably hurl themselves towards it. Over time, though, I think that unfortunately, helmet wearing has created a false sense of security. It has led to increasing recklessness, particularly in sports like football. I love what sports writer Cathal Kelly has to say. The problem with the NFL and every other league that mandates helmet use is that helmets only mitigate the damage that you're doing to your head. They operate on the same theory that suggests mummifying yourself in bubble wrap and jumping out a third-story window should be a fun way to pass an afternoon. I also like what Jerry Seinfeld has to say. He says, "The only thing dumber than the helmet is the helmet law, the point of which is to protect a brain that is functioning so poorly, it's not even trying to stop the cracking of the head that it's in." I should admit that sometimes I ride my bike without a helmet. And when I ride without a helmet, I am much more aware of the peril I could be in were I to fall off my bike. These thoughts are far less frequent when I do wear my helmet. With my helmet on, I fly down hills at stupid speeds. My helmet makes me feel safer than I actually am. It turns out I'm not alone in this. Recent research demonstrates that people who wear bike helmets engage in more risk-taking behavior than those who do not. Why? Because helmet-wearing cyclists act according to the belief that wearing a helmet reduces their risk, so they compensate by cycling faster and more aggressively. I think that perhaps there is a temptation to treat our faith and belief in God the way we might want to treat a helmet. It is comforting to think that by placing our faith and trust in God, we will be less at risk of terrible things happening to us. But like a cyclist on a freeway, we live in a crazy, chaotic world, and I just can't bring myself to believe it's one where God bends reality and fate to serve me, one of 7 billion and plus counting people in the world, in a singular, individual way. All helmets, including the one I just smashed on the ground, come with some sort of warning sticker that says, "No helmet can prevent all head injuries or death." I believe that the purpose of placing my trust and hope in God is not so that I will be spared hardship, pain, or even untimely death, but rather by placing trust in God, I hope to be granted with enough courage and inner strength to be able to go out into the world without being overcome by a fear of darkness, both in the world and in myself. In Ephesians 6, Paul uses some powerful metaphoric imagery to describe the value of equipping ourselves with the armor of God. He ends his passage writing, "Take the helmet of God, take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God." Paul has no illusions about what the armor of God can and cannot do. As Brad reminded us last Sunday, Paul suffered immensely during his ministry. If the armor of God were to have its own warning label, it would be well summarized by Paul's writing in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 8 to 12, in which he shares these powerful words. He writes, "We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. For we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life in you." A bike helmet saved my sister's life. The helmet of salvation, it might well save yours.
Dishes. I hate them. The clumsy cookie sheet, the slippery salad spinner, digging for that piece of overcooked pasta in the colander, scraping off the baked-on tomato sauce. Dishes. I loathe them. Wrinkled fingers fishing for forks among the flotsam and jetsam of the oily, lukewarm water that should have been changed 10 minutes ago. Dishes? Why me? Thank goodness I'm the designated dryer. But is there an order to all of this disorder? Is it like a tape recorder? And we rewind it just once more. And yet, despite the cyclical monotony of the washing and the drying and the washing and the drying, something magical can happen during this mundane, everyday act. The divine meeting the ordinary. A French brother of ours from the 1600s wrote something that I took to heart when I was 15, many years ago, scraping greasy grills and washing heavy-duty utensils at the local McDonald's. He said, "God has many ways of drawing us to himself." And his words followed me in my early 20s when I found myself yet again in a little kitchen, this time in a fine dining restaurant. No, not as a sous chef, but as a grimy dishwasher trying to steal kisses from a certain waitress. This barefooted Carmelite monk known as Brother Lawrence wrote a collection of letters published well after his death. His letters became known as a little published work titled The Practice of the Presence of God. And the simplicity of his profound meditations, they still resonate with me today. He would pray, "Lord of all pots and pans and things, make me a saint by getting meals and washing up the plates." So you see, I'm a saint for all of my dishwashing experience. But I think Brother Lawrence had something quite different in mind when he was praying for sainthood. He said, "The time of business does not with me differ from the time of prayer. And in the noise and clatter of my kitchen, I possess God in as great tranquility as if I were upon my knees at the Blessed Sacrament." He makes that sound so easy. But like the practice of appreciating a good wine, the practice of the presence of God is exactly that. A practice that takes time, involving our senses, our third eye, acknowledging that no matter our circumstance or position at home, work, or leisure, God is a breath away. This is something I struggle to remember, and I can use all the practice that I can get. In our hurried, self-absorbed worlds, James, the half-brother of Jesus, reminds me, "Come near to God, and he will come near to you. Humble yourself before the Lord, and he will lift you up." What can be more humbling than doing the dishes?
So I wake up, I brush my teeth, I make my coffee, I'm almost ready to go. I grab my laptop bag and I do my typical PKW, phone, keys, wallet. Check my phone, I have my phone. Check my wallet, I have my wallet. Check my keys, I don't have my keys. I'm like, oh, okay, let's go. So I immediately go to the kitchen counter, nothing there. I look through the pants I was wearing the night before, nothing there. I flip over all the couch cushions, nothing there. I start to panic a little bit. I'm running around checking everything in sight, and it's nowhere to be found. I start to realize that I have lost my keys. And with them goes all sense of perspective, with them goes my plan for the day, and with them goes my cool. I'm trapped. I start going through my stages of searching for a lost object. Stage one, logic. I retrace my steps. I'm starting to look in all the places that make sense. I try to remain calm and rational. And I remember, oh, yes, I saw it the day before. I haven't left the house. They're here somewhere. I'm going to find them. I check the bedroom, the living room, the kitchen, the bathroom. Nothing. I also remember that I had done laundry recently, so I checked the hamper and inside the washer and the dryer. Still nothing. Stage two, self-condemnation. As I'm checking each room and I'm scanning all the shelves, I begin to mutter under my breath, oh, I'm such an idiot. Where are those keys? Why do I always do this? And I can't use my spare car key because I want it to be all fancy and get the auto start for the winter. They had to permanently install the key in the car. Was it worth it? Stage three, confusion. It's been 15 minutes. At this point, the neighbors can hear me yelling. I start to look in places that don't make any sense at all. The pantry, the garbage, drawers that I never open, my winter coat pockets, and this is the middle of the summer. And literally every minute I'm checking the exact pants I'm wearing as if somehow I missed a big chunk of metal in my pocket. Stage four, despair. I stop and I cry out, God, please, I know that you know where they are. So just please, just give me a sign. Nothing happens. 20 minutes have passed, and I start to have a mild theological crisis over here. I start to wonder why God lets bad things happen to good people. What am I missing? What is he trying to teach me right now? Stage five, surrender. I give up. I plop on the couch. And I'm thinking, well, I'm never going to find these keys. It's worthless. What's the point of anything? Everything is worthless. Morning's ruined, the day's ruined, stupid keys. After some time, I get myself together and I stand and I start the cycle from the beginning again. Eventually, I found the keys, it turns out. And it doesn't matter how, it doesn't matter where. What matters is that it wasn't that big of a deal. I eventually got to work. My manager understood. It was just a hiccup in the day. It was just a tiny, forgettable moment. But it was also the apocalypse. In the literal sense, apocalypse literally means an unveiling, an uncovering, a revelation. In my anger, grumbling, self-berating, cursing, doubt, and despair, it was revealed to me for a few minutes how important control is to me and how little of it I actually have. In its absence, and while feeling stuck and stressed, those parts of me that I prefer to keep hidden were momentarily unveiled and uncovered. Small things go wrong. I get flustered, distracted, obsessed. I lose track of what's important, of what matters. I lose control. I focus on the short term, not the long term, not the big picture. And when everything's going great, all according to plan, I can seem like a pretty good person. But when little things go wrong and my plans are interrupted, my true self starts to appear. My cracks show. And I see that I'm profoundly in need of grace. The neuroses, the weakness that I try to pretty up and manage through control, ease, and privilege are suddenly on display. But here's the thing. Pretty good people don't need Jesus. He came for the lost. He came for the broken. He came to say, chill. Don't worry about it. He came to say, let me help you. Oh, and remember when I said it doesn't matter where the keys were? It's completely kidding. Of course it matters. So, do you know when you open up your washer and there's that like rubber thing all around? I had to peel that back and find the big chunk of keys in there with a bunch of change, and that's where they were. So, true story.
Well, I wonder, are you like me? Do you dread those three little words? You know, as someone approaches you and smiles and then speaks, how are you? There are days when this simple platitude becomes a painful reminder that my honest answer would really be terrible. But such acknowledgement, in most cases, is an answer that would make the greeter squirm, and as they try to cajole me into admitting that things aren't really that bad, so instead, I just muster a weak smile and offer good thanks and continue with the usual pleasantries of normal, friendly conversation. I recognize that everyone has their ups and downs and that in the big picture, I really am not that badly off, even at the worst of times. That is why I resist revealing my instinctive negativity at times like this. However, if you really want to know how I am doing at any particular point in my life, I have discovered the best barometer of my inner life. It is my refrigerator. I have come to see a refrigerator as the weather vane of the soul. There are those who always maintain a minimum of content in their refrigerator. You know the ones. Their lives are organized, neat, always with a minimum of disruption and variation. They always need to know what is inside their refrigerator and their lives at all times. And so they maintain a steady, predictable pace. On the contrary, I like to keep my refrigerator well stocked with a variety of tastes and textures. I've always had an assortment of condiments and sauces and flavorings on hand so that I can cater to a wealth of cravings for entertaining and comfort at a moment's notice. Over time, my fridge, like my life, becomes filled with spontaneous impulses and whims for the unusual and the adventurous. However, as my own life becomes just that bit too busy and overcrowded, so my refrigerator seems to become the same. At such times, things become unmanageable and unwittingly spill over. Things must constantly be rearranged to keep the door from springing open at inopportune times. And even though the quantity of food within seems to be much more than sufficient, there are key ingredients missing for creating a truly healthy and balanced meal. As one delves deeper into the recesses, one discovers things that have soured and spoiled from neglect. Items which were once piquant and tasty have now lost their flavor and their nutrition and can serve only to poison the soul. And all the embarrassment should someone offer to put something back into my refrigerator and catch a whiff of that souring smell and see what a mess I really am in. I always reach a point at which that clutter just becomes too overwhelming. I struggle to regain control over my surroundings, both inward and outward, and I begin to frantically clean house. As I reassess my real needs and priorities, my refrigerator is cleared of that stale and rotting material. The remaining food is methodically organized into logical clusters as it once was before. As my life begins to turn around, I replenish the stock of nourishment in order to be properly prepared once again for those impromptu meals and snacks prepared with friends. Once more, my fridge and my life is presentable, and I can invite visitors into its inner sanctum with pride. And all is well with the world. So the next time you see me and you ask how I am, you can still bet that my reply will be, good, thanks, and our conversation as friends will continue on. However, if you are genuinely curiously to know how I really am, please don't ask. Just come over and peek in my refrigerator.
Our lives are filled with ordinary tasks, ordinary things, and ordinary moments. And rather than wishing that time away, we perhaps need to lean into the mundane, that trivial daily stuff, and learn to embrace the ordinary and what it can teach us about life and faith. If we start intentionally thinking differently about the ordinary, retraining our minds to look for the hidden beauty in our everyday awareness, maybe we will eventually begin seeing the shadow of the divine in all people and things. Tish Harrison Warren, in her book Liturgy of the Ordinary, states, "The crucible of our formation is in the monotony of our daily routines. Rather than thinking about our faith in terms of being radical or revolutionary, perhaps just honing in on faithfulness in the mundane moments is where we will actually grow. So much of our existence revolves around all things food, the cultivation, preparation, indulgence, and cleanup. Day after day, we get caught up in the humdrum of securing nourishment. Sitting at a table with food and drink is such a mundane act. There really is nothing inherently sacred about it. Yet Christianity itself is rooted in this inherently sacred and in this ordinary yet subversive practice. A dinner table where everyone is welcome, where those despised and marginalized are not only accepted, but honored. At the Last Supper, Jesus tells his disciples to eat and drink in remembrance of him. Jesus could have suggested something much more impressive and interesting for his disciples to remember him by, and yet he chooses the unremarkable. Plain old bread and wine. He focuses on one of the most ordinary of acts, eating, through which to be remembered by his people. He takes eating, the sharing of bread and wine, and makes it sacred. Jesus himself does the transforming work of taking this mundane act and making it a spiritually nourishing brush with the divine. And so, this morning, we return to the table. The meal, the ritual that Jesus asked us to remember. Please follow along as we read the following response and join me by speaking the words in bold. And just a reminder that everyone is welcome to participate. There are no barriers here. But you are also welcome to choose not to. There is no pressure. As we gather around this ordinary table, look beyond, we can see. We look beyond and we remember. We look beyond and we give thanks. For the sacred ordinary.
We give thanks.
For the beauty so mundane.
We give thanks.
For the divine incarnate.
We give thanks.
For the surprising everyday.
We give thanks.
For these objects that are so common. For these things we hardly notice. For this meal so simple and plain. And as we move about our week this week,
may we remember to pause and interlace, to pay attention in our busy lives, to the ordinary as a precious life.
The grain that nourishes, the grocery store clerk who smiles at us, the sun that ripens vineyards, the transport truck that delivers, the factory workers who made this cup, your grace that surprises us, your creation that sustains us.
As we drink from your bread and drink from this plain old cup, may we remember the sacred all around us.
May we remember
you in sacrifice. May we remember your table where all are welcome.
We would now invite you to visit this station here and to receive the bread and the cup of wine or grape juice. This is a symbol of receiving what Jesus has given us: forgiveness, love, grace, and the Spirit of God. Please know you don't have to come, no pressure, but all are welcome to come and receive.
Let us turn our hearts and minds towards God in prayer. Praise be to you, O Lord, who spins shining stars across the wondrous heavens and stretches out the seas, who lifts the dawn into place and sets boundaries for night, who awes the earth with storms and gentles it with green, who gives everything a season and breathes life and love into the dust of me. Praise be to you. Praise in all things, for all things. The soft slant of sunlight, the sweat of battle, a song in the wilderness, and the evening breeze, the deep breath, the tended wound, mercy, quietness, a friend, for the miracles of the daily and the mysteries of the eternal. Praise be to you. Praise from all creatures, laughers and list makers, wonders and worriers, poets and plotters and prophets, the wrinkled, the newborn, the whale and the worm. From all and from me, praise. Praise be to you for amazing grace. Go in peace.